The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Susan Dellinger from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Oprah Magazine, September 2018, Volume 20, Number 9. And this is the final installment of the September issue. Due to Hurricane Florence, we managed to miss one installment in the middle of the month, so there are actually only three recordings from this month. The September cover has a 70s vibe. In a close-up shot, Oprah looks directly at the camera from behind large, almost cat-eyed, acrylic-framed, rose-tinted sunglasses. A sunflower-yellow felt fedora sits at a jaunty angle, the brim covering her forehead. She wears a tunic in that same sunflower yellow, and this month's headline is, "What if you saw things differently?" And let's jump right into the Live Your Best Life section of the magazine. And we have part two of the Martha Beck series. And this part is called Peace Offering. After enduring painful losses, Kate Glenn is fighting chronic anxiety. But life coach Martha Beck says it's time to call a truce. Though Kate Glenn, 36, owns a children's book and toy shop in Northampton, Massachusetts, she knows her heart's not in retail. For 12 years, she's been seeking her true purpose along with true love, but has had no luck. So she's called in reinforcements, namely Martha Beck. When O's life coach detected underlying anxiety in her new client, Kate agreed and gave her some background. The hyper-responsible daughter of divorced parents, Kate was hospitalized for ulcerative colitis in college. Shortly thereafter, her father died and her mother suffered a massive stroke. "Have you really relaxed since then?" asked Martha. And Kate admitted, "I'd say no." Her homework? Daily 15-minute sessions of meditation, simply observing and labeling her feelings, whether agitated or calm. Martha then gave Kate a coping strategy for those inevitable moments of panic. So how's it been going? Let's check in. Martha: "Hi, Kate. I'm eager to hear what's been happening since the last time we talked." Kate: "You were right. Meditation brings up a lot of panicky feelings. Actually, they're always there, but I'm more aware of them when I'm sitting still. You'd mentioned that if I start to freak out, I can think of the way I'd soothe a crying baby, but I found that idea challenging. When I shift into caretaker mode, I get stuck. It's difficult to put myself in the position of being held." Martha: "Being vulnerable is very scary for you. When you went through the trauma of losing your dad, and essentially your mom, too, you closed yourself out of self-protection, which is logical. But I think of the quote, often attributed to Anais Nin, 'The day came when the risk to remain tight in a bud was more painful than the risk it took to blossom.' You're suffering, but that suffering is ultimately what will drive you to open up again. So I'm sitting right here, and I'm not going to let anything happen. Can you take a deep breath?" Kate: "Okay." And she inhales deeply. Martha: "Now breathe out and let your jaw drop a little. Feel that tiny wave of relaxation across your face. That's a little reward for your nervous system. Have you heard of soft gaze in yoga?" Kate: "Yes." Martha: "Keep breathing and try perceiving everything in the room is equally important, all the way to the periphery of your vision. There's nothing in particular you're staring at. This soft focus attention takes the nervous system out of fight or flight mode." Kate: "I can shift into that state, but then I lose it again." Martha: "It takes practice. Say, floor to ceiling, wall to wall, all things equal. Use that little jingle to remind yourself to go back into soft focus. This is how a baby who isn't stressed experiences the world. When babies are born, their eyes can't focus up close. Their breathing is deep and rhythmic, coming right from the belly. We're doing these body-based exercises because I believe you were living in a state of tension long before your trauma in college. Maybe it set in before you could even talk. Okay, breathe deeply again and try saying, I can trust my breath to keep going. Does that ring true to you? Kate, actually no, which is ridiculous. Of course it will. Martha, can you visualize that resistance? Kate, I can feel it in my diaphragm. It's a ball of tension, a big, smooth ball. Martha, say to that big ball of intense, crunched pressure, you're welcome here. You don't have to believe it, just say it. Can you do that? Kate, yes, this big ball and I have spent a lot of time together. Martha, it's been there for you all your life, helping you cope. It's like a brave soldier standing guard. Kate, that's interesting because over the last couple of years, mostly when I think about relationships, I feel like I'm sitting behind a wall of sandbags. I've stacked them up and I've got my little army hat on. Sometimes I'll peer over and say to people, do you have permission to come in? Is your paperwork in order? Martha, how about saying, nobody's coming in? Tell that soldier she doesn't have to let anybody in until it feels safe. Instead, say, you're doing an amazing job. I brought you some tea. Sit down. Is she tired? Kate, yeah, she's been on patrol for a while. She might take the tea, but she can't stop pacing. Martha, all right, can she build the wall higher and thicker? Say it's made of tempered steel. She can put a roof on it and make a vault. She's safe inside. Let her wall everyone out and sit down with her tea in this steel vault. Kate, she still gets to feel anxious, right? Martha, she can be shaking and covered in blood, sweat, and tears, but the bunker welcomes her. Nothing's coming for her in this moment, which is the only one that matters. We're not thinking about what could happen in an hour or what happened yesterday. She's okay right now. You have to look at what's actually in front of you and trust that you're okay, too. Kate, that is hard. Martha, it's one of the hardest things there is, but think about what's happened since we began this conversation. Can you see that nothing's traumatized you since you've been sitting here? You trust that soldier inside, right? Kate, I do. Martha, fantastic. We've discovered the one trustworthy thing you've had. The absolute last thing I'd ask you to do is forget about her. We talked about thinking of the vulnerable, fretful part of yourself as a fussy baby. Can that soldier, the part of you that's always on the alert for danger, guard the baby? She doesn't have to pick her up. Just guard her. Can you see that in your mind's eye? Kate, yes. Martha, excellent. So as you breathe, try saying, I can trust myself to stay on guard. Can you believe that? Kate, I can actually. Martha, so we found a tiny margin of trust to work with. You don't have to push any further. Don't think about letting your guard down. Don't try to force yourself to be calm. But can you thank that soldier for staying on guard for these 36 years you've been alive? Kate, I feel like she doesn't deserve it. That's her job. Martha, the fact that a soldier is doing her job doesn't mean we don't want to walk up and say, thank you for your service, even if you believe the war she's fighting is unjust. You know, it hasn't been easy. Kate, I see what you mean. Martha, if you can extend gratitude toward her, she may begin to understand that you're the ally, not the enemy. Does that sound possible? Kate, I'll try. It's exasperating to have that pit of anxiety in my body. It actually takes energy. But at the same time, the thought of letting go is also draining. It feels like I'm trying to change myself into someone else. I'm so used to that narrative of, I'm going to be this way forever. Martha, that's why I want you to welcome that hypervigilant part of yourself. When you try to fight your anxiety, grabbing it and wrestling it to the ground, it can't leave. You've got it by the lapels. Loosen your grip, and maybe she'll get comfortable enough to sit down and take a break, or leave her post entirely. So keep meditating and try to honor that soldier. Wrap yourself up in a blanket. Get an actual cup of hot tea, or whatever it is that makes you feel good inside, and imagine yourself offering that to her. She's worked hard for you, and you've worked hard here today, so I want to honor you too. Thank you. Kate, Thank you, I'm exhausted. Martha, I bet you are, honey. At ease, go take a well-deserved nap, and let's get together again in a few weeks. Martha Beck is the author of most recently, Diana Herself, An Allegory of Awakening. Let's move now from the Live Your Best Life section of the magazine to the reading room. And our first review is of the book Ohio by Stephen Markley. The review is entitled You Can't Go Home Again, a first-time novelist detects a tempest in the heartland. Ohio, Stephen Markley's debut, is a big book, not just in heft, it's nearly 500 pages, but in scope, ambition, and ideas. It's a descendant of the Dickensian social novel by way of Jonathan Franzen, epic fiction that lays bare contemporary culture clashes, showing us who we are and how we got there. Set in 2013 in the fictional town of New Canaan, whose purple state divisions make it a microcosm of modern America, Ohio tells the tale of four lost souls mired in the past. Now in their late 20s, the friends are returning to the Cane on the same night, hoping to reconnect with their high school sweethearts and in some cases settle a score. Bill's an alcoholic idealist, tasked by his estranged ex with delivering a mysterious package. Stacy, a lesbian PhD candidate studying the intersection of literature and ecology, is in town to confront her one-time girlfriend's spiteful mother, whose disavowal drove them apart. Dan is a veteran of two tours in Iraq and one in Afghanistan, shell-shocked equally by war and by a breakup with the woman he sees as the love of his life. And Tina just wants vengeance on her former beau, a star athlete whose abuse has haunted her long enough. All the tension might be a bit heavy if Markley's prose weren't as lively as a bonfire, crackling with incisive details. The, quote, Appalachian's accented wind, end of quote, of the local speech, long-haul truckers listening to Tom Clancy audiobooks, Walmart, quote, lit up like an army base, end of quote. Markley's gift is keeping one eye on these intimate specifics and the other on the expansive landscape of modern American life. His characters' issues elucidate the universal discontents. Economic inequality, addiction, homophobia, endless war, unchecked masculinity that define the way we live now. And next in the reading room is an article entitled The Story of Us. Jacqueline Woodson, the National Book Award-winning author of Brown Girl Dreaming, is spreading the gospel of reading. And Jacqueline writes, fiction serves as both a mirror and a window. As a child, I read widely and wrote constantly, scrawling in notebooks that I quickly filled. And I prayed. We were Jehovah's Witnesses who for years moved back and forth between Brooklyn and Greenville, South Carolina. I felt out of place no matter where we were. And while books enabled me to forget my awkwardness for a little while, it wasn't until I was 13 that I encountered a fictional character. In Mildred D. Taylor's 1976 novel, Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry, about whom I felt, yes, she could be me. She was Cassie Logan, a 9-year-old black girl whose Mississippi family is struggling during the Great Depression to hang on to the 400 acres of land they worked so hard to acquire. Cassie's deep love of her family, her spats with her siblings, her fear of those who threatened them, her resilience, all were at once deeply familiar to me and entirely new. I turned the pages hungrily, spending hours huddled underneath our backyard porch in Brooklyn, hidden away from everyone, dying to know what Cassie would do next. It was as if she were speaking directly to me. That book forever changed how I inhabited the world, mirror and window. Today, I am the National Ambassador for Young People's Literature, and in that role, it's my hope to do for kids what Taylor's book did for me, to connect them with stories in which they can see themselves, and perhaps come to realize that while we're all different, we're all the same. That desire takes me to every corner of our country. Bookstores, community centers, schools, libraries, prisons, to communicate this. Reading leads to both hope and change. Here are three children's books I love for their urgency and call to action. And the first book is The People Shall Continue by Simon J. Ortiz, with illustrations by Cheryl Graves. This remarkable book was first published in 1977, but it's still timely. It provides a compact overview of Native American history, from creation story to the desolation and theft of land by white explorers and settlers, presented as an oral narrative and cadenced like a piece of music. Quote, "Maybe there was a small change in the wind. Maybe there was a shift in the stars. Maybe it was a dream that someone dreamed." End of quote. It's as if the ancestors were singing to us so that we can sing along and, despite everything, remember this. Quote, "Nothing is separate from us. We are all one body of people." End of quote. The second book is Not My Idea, a book about whiteness by Anastasia Higginbotham. A young white boy begins to become aware of injustices against people of color in reaction to news coverage of a police shooting and a young brown boy in a gift shop being followed by a security guard while white customers are left to roam free. As the protagonist starts to pose questions, quote, "Who is that with their hands up? Why is that policeman screaming at him?" End of quote. He becomes more and more confused and frustrated by his parents' responses. Quote, "We don't see color." "You don't need to worry about this. You're safe." End of quote. For white folks who aren't sure how to talk to their kids about race, this book is the perfect beginning. At the end, a garden is planted beneath the handwritten words, quote, "Grow justice inside yourself like a bean sprout in a milk carton." End of quote. And the third and final book is How Mamas Love Their Babies by Juniper Fitzgerald, with illustrations by Elise Peterson. When I first came upon this book, I thought, wow, the women on these pages are so fierce and so real. The dynamic, colorful illustrations, collages of photos and drawings, depict mothers from all walks of life. The mix of pilots, house cleaners, waitresses, and exotic dancers. Quote, "Some mamas dance all night long in special shoes. It's hard work." End of quote. Suggests that a mother's parenting skills cannot be measured by the size of her paycheck or how she earns it. I also love that the book shows women caring for their kids in other ways. A pregnant woman doing yoga. Quote, "Mamas care for their babies even before their babies are born." End of quote. Women marching. Carrying a "We Shall Overcome" sign in one hand and a child in the other. Yes, kids, mamas rock. Now, the next review is of the book The Third Hotel by Laura Vandenberg. The review is called Widow's Walk. In Laura Vandenberg's latest, the line between grief and badness dissolves. Quote, "What is she doing in Havana?" End of quote. It's a question with no obvious answer, but one that Claire, the wandering widow at the center of The Third Hotel, Laura Vandenberg's eerily gorgeous novel, poses to herself. Officially, she's there to attend the premiere of Revolution Zombie, the first horror movie shot in Cuba. Her husband was a film scholar with an interest in scopophilia, or the, quote, "morbid urge to gaze," end of quote, and the trip was booked for the two of them until a hit and run left him dead, or something like that. In what Claire perceives alternately as a miracle, a nightmare, or a mental breakdown, she begins to see her husband traipsing through the streets as if on vacation. Claire orders herself to stop recognizing him, quote, since what she was recognizing was plainly impossible. But then she crept closer and saw just how possible it was, end of quote. While the hypnotic tale is all about zombies and ghosts, it's mostly a metaphysical mystery whose dread is rooted in the impossibility of ever fully knowing those we love. Not that that stops Claire from trying. She cancels her flight home, loses her job, and tracks her dead spouse through a museum to his hotel room and ultimately into bed. Afterward, Claire curls up and sobs, quote, broken by overness, end of quote. If one thing is clear in this elegiac terror, it's that nothing truly ends. Even the novel itself, once finished, seems to continue beyond the last page, like a dream that stays with you long after waking. And now our next review is of the book The Prison Letters of Nelson Mandela, edited by Sam Ventner. The review is entitled Freedom Rider. A son of the revolution sifts through a legendary leader's epistolary gifts. Quote, I feel on top of the world and am looking forward to the day when I will again see you enjoy once more the happy moments we have spent together in the past, end of quote. This ends a note handwritten in 1967 by Nelson Mandela to my father. It appears in The Prison Letters of Nelson Mandela, edited by Sam Ventner, a collection of 255 letters composed during Mandela's 10,052 days of incarceration and published in what would have been his 100th year. My father, Cecil Epril, was the white editor of Johannesburg's Golden City Post, a newspaper staffed by and serving black South Africans, and in their shared mission to abolish apartheid, he and the great man had become friends. Back then, being close to Mandela, nicknamed at the time the Black Pimpernel, was to risk arrest. Doing what my father did in a racist police state was a tightrope act that required us all to be on our guard. My dad often broke the law just by doing his job. To entertain a black employee in our house was a crime. He was really rolling the dice when Mandela, the most wanted man in the country, showed up at our home for dinner disguised as a chauffeur. Danger lurked quite literally everywhere in those days, and my father often got impatient with my brother and me when we let anything slip about our lives to strangers, teachers, or even neighbors, some of whom he suspected of reporting on us. Quote, oh, my dad is down at the pool reading the Sunday papers, end of quote, I once told one of his colleagues on the phone. When I related what I'd said, Dad was furious. He yelled, quote, never tell anyone where I am or what I'm doing, end of quote. For years, I've worked to understand how heavily all the clandestine activity weighed on my father. Mandela's letter sheds new light on the man he was. When Mandela's ascension to the presidency of South Africa now appears inevitable, back then it seemed far more likely that he'd die behind bars. His letters attest to the qualities that helped him triumph. Love, particularly for his second wife, Winnie, played a major part. He wrote of her, quote, your letters form a solid wall between me and senility, and I am never certain whether I'm aging or rejuvenating, end of quote. They also show him to be a caring father who, like my own, mixed concern with sternness. He reached out to Dad to ask for help with a son who'd been expelled from school for taking part in a protest. Writing, quote, he may also be feeling lonely and unhappy. It may be better to call him to your office and discuss the matter, end of quote. He lamented that from prison he was unable to support his family. He wrote, quote, during the last 4 years, I parasited on Winnie, end of quote. But what shines through, even in the darkest times, is Mandela's lively spirit, as when he joked with the wife of a fellow prisoner that wearing purdah during her visits denied him a glimpse of her beauty. My father's death 25 years ago of a heart attack denied me the chance to know more about the valiant work he did in South Africa and where he got the courage to do it. In reading these letters, I'm reminded that his ferociousness was about protecting us and fighting the best of all fights in comradeship with one of the greatest warriors of all time. And finally, we have a short review here of the book How to Love a Jamaican by Alexia Arthurs. And the review is entitled Sea of Love. Images of mermaids swim throughout How to Love a Jamaican, Alexia Arthur's shimmering story collection. A pair surfaces in the story Slack, the tragic tale of a mother whose starry-eyed daughters drown while pretending to be sirens of the deep. In the story, Shirley from a Small Place, a Rihanna-like pop star poses as a finned beauty for a video shoot before returning to her native island to recover from an abusive relationship and a friend's death. Mermaids are a fitting metaphor for the women here, still pining for turquoise waters even as they put down roots in Brooklyn or Iowa. Authors captures the ambivalence of belonging and displacement, with its singular mix of psychological precision and sun-kissed lyricism. This dazzling debut marks the emergence of a knockout new voice. Let's move now from the reading room back to the Live Your Best Life section of the magazine, and let's look at this month's gratitude meter. Five things we're smiling about, and the items go from awe to awesome. The first one is lit. This tiny but incendiary library pays homage to once restricted books, but don't judge a book by its matchbox. In honor of Banned Books Week, September 23rd through 29th, go and read the real things for yourself. And what we have here is a little stack of matchboxes. And the covers are the covers from Banned Books. The one on top with the little drawer slid open so you can see the matches is Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451. And the three others in here are The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, Song of Solomon, and Slaughterhouse-Five. So go to outofprintclothing.com to get these match boxes for yourself. And the second item, we have a couple of children standing here holding lunch bags. And these lunch bags, brown lunch bags, have portraits of each of these children on them. Happy Meals. Some children get PBJ for lunch. Isaac and Zelina Jinx get a weekly masterpiece, courtesy of their dad, Lionel, in whose hands the humble brown paper bag is a canvas for portraits of presidents like Obama, superheroes like Black Panther, and even the kids themselves, as shown here. And you can go to @brownbagbrowndad. To see more. And in the middle of the pack, we have some pencils, classic pencils in different colors, and they have that imprint in gold on the side, and they're grammar lessons writ small. Have trouble telling there, T-H-E-R-E, from there, T-H-E-I-R, from there, T-H-E-Y apostrophe R-E. Sharpen your command of English with this clever pencil set. Each number 2 points out words that commonly trip us up. All right, question mark? All right, W-R-I-T-E, exclamation point. NewtonandtheApple.com to find those pencils. And next we have a scene from a cartoon by The Simpsons creator. Fresh Air, H-E-I-R. Think of her as the older beer-drinking cousin of Lisa Simpson. She's Princess Bean, voiced by Abby Jacobson, the medievally put-upon heroine of Simpsons creator Matt Groening's new Netflix series, Disenchantment. A feminist-minded cartoon for the hashtag MeToo era. And finally, coming in at awesome, we have a picture of a woman sitting in a wheelchair, and the wheel has been covered with a disc that's this bright pastel kaleidoscope design that looks like the points on, you know, the marking on a map that shows north, south, east, and west, with the stars overlaid on top of each other. So the description says, Hot Wheels, Izzy Keene's drab ride never matched her bubbly personality. So she and her sister, Elby, joined forces to launch a line of stylish plastic wheel covers for anyone who wants a chair with flair. Go to izzywheels.com to find out more. And across the bottom of the page, we have Creature Comforts, the pet set. Life with furry companions isn't all fetch and catnip. Here are three more highbrow delights to enjoy this fall. And the first one, cheerleaders. If Lassie's heart-tugging heroics were true, they'd resemble those in Pick of the Litter. The documentary, out August 31st, follows five puppy siblings, Patriot, Phil, Poppet, Potomac, and Primrose, as they train for 2 years to become guide dogs for the blind. And we have a picture here of a blonde lab puppy. The lows are low, a foster family's heartbreak over saying goodbye. The highs are high, the first meeting between a pup and his grateful partner. But all the dogs, even those who don't make the cut, are still very good boys and girls. And the second of three selections, Cat's Cradle. Raymond Chandler had Taki, Colette had Seha, and Jorge Luis Borges had Beppo. They all show up in the new photography collection, Writers and Their Cats, featuring portraits of famous authors and their whiskered friends. Come for the behind-the-scenes stories. Edith Sitwell once used an aspiring poet's manuscript as lining for a cat bed. Stay for the cutest picture of a kitten covered. Stephen King ever. And our third and final selection, A Dog's Life. Artist Myra Kalman's five-book series on Max the Dog follows the beagle poet around the world. Falling for his wife, a Dalmatian named Crepe Suzette in Paris, pursuing fame in Hollywood. In Kalman's recently reissued Swami on Rye from 1995, Max, along with a riddle-spouting genie, travels to India and gets existential in temples, rickshaws, and more. Kalman's tale is meant for tykes, but full-grown readers will love her lush drawings and whimsical wordplay, too. Still in Live Your Best Life, under the subtitle One to Watch, we have Ms. Winfrey Goes to Washington. And this page is full of pictures of items from the new special exhibit at the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C., that explores Oprah's history-making legacy. We found the perfect person to give us a private tour. And we have a picture of Oprah standing in front of the introduction to her exhibit, which says, Watching Oprah, the Oprah Winfrey Show and American Culture. Oprah is standing there in a silver and black graphic printed dress, deep V neckline, and her hair pulled back and dangly earrings. The first item from this exhibit is a model of Oprah's childhood church. And it is a simple, white, wooden-framed, tin-roofed structure. Oprah says, My religious upbringing is why I am who I am, and Buffalo United Methodist Church in Mississippi is where I developed my own values. I first spoke in public there at age 3, and that was the foundation for my broadcasting career. The second item is the Presidential Medal of Freedom from 2013. The medal is a white star, which is just a little bit larger than, and on top of, a red pentagon. In the center of the white star is a circle that has 13 gold stars in it. And then bordering all of that are five eagles with the outstretched wings, the classic American eagle with the head slightly to the side, and their wings tips are touching each other at the points of the stars. And all of this hangs on a deep blue ribbon. Oprah says, when I arrived at the White House to receive this, they wouldn't let me in because my name wasn't on the list. I had to stand out in the rain, and I remember thinking, photos from today are going to last forever, and my hair is all puffed up. The third item is Oprah's high school ID card from 1967, and it's a laminated aqua card number 0523 from Nicolette High School. It has Oprah's signature on it and numbers around it, and the underneath the black and white picture of her, 1967-68. Oprah says, Mr. Abrams was a teacher in the inner city high school I went to in Milwaukee. He thought I deserved better, so he helped me get into Nicolette High School. It was an interesting time because I was just one of two black kids in a school of 2,000 white students. The fourth item is a diary, a five-year diary with a worn yellow cover with a big white daisy on front and a lock on it. Her teenage diary, circa 1970, of which Oprah says, this journal is filled with a 15-year-old's angst. I wrote about how Anthony wanted to take me out, but my dad said no because he once dated my friend Mildred. But Mildred no longer liked Anthony, so why couldn't I date him? The fifth item is a picture of Oprah on set in these deep, oversized beige chairs. Oprah says, the chairs on the show originally had cloth upholstery, but when John F. Kennedy Jr. came on as a guest, they left lint on his suit. They were immediately recovered in leather. Number six, the Oprah Winfrey Show t-shirt from 1991. It's a white t-shirt, and there's a cartoon-like drawing of Oprah leaning forward to pull a wagon. Oprah's wearing a yellow dress, a teal jacket, and teal shoes. The wagon's purple. She's holding in one hand a kind of lavender flag that says 5th anniversary. Oprah says, somebody on staff designed this for our 5th anniversary. Back then, I didn't think we had 20 years left. Every 2 years, I'd say, I'm tired. Maybe it's time to end this. But when, for the film Beloved, I reenacted what my ancestors went through, I realized I had no right to claim I was tired. And the final item. Well, actually, it's two items. One's a big red bow, like you would put on a wreath at Christmas. And the other is the red suit. And it's a suit that Oprah wore on the show when they gave away cars to the audience. It's a very slender two-piece suit. The skirt's kind of a pencil skirt that kind of angles in a little bit at the knees, very tapered. And the jacket's a short jacket and has three-quarter length sleeves. It's double-breasted, and it's very structured. Kind of reminds you of Jackie Kennedy. It has a wide shawl collar. And like I said, it's double-breasted, and it has this very neat stitching and seam at the waist and about a 5-inch peplum that hits just above the hips. Oprah says, when we gave away cars to audience members, nothing went unplanned. The keys were taped down in their boxes. The bows were the right size. Gail didn't think I should wear the red suit because it was too formal, but I knew I wanted to match the bows. Love is in the details. The exhibit, Watching Oprah, is open through June 2019. And now, still in the Live Your Best Life section of the magazine, under the heading Connections, the title, Who's Her Daddy? A Doting Parent, a Career Drinker, a Raconteur, a Ghost. Margot Mifflin parses the memories in search of her father. Margot writes, my father died when I was 10, and my memories of him barely fill a paragraph. He's watching me tool around on a plastic fire truck as a toddler. He's on the porch serving fried chicken on my birthday. He's calling, hey, Joe, to a salesman the day I get the Schwinn Stingray I later crashed in the woods. He's buying a Halloween pumpkin. He's singing, You Are My Sunshine. He's smoking Pall Mells on the lawn one summer night, letting me stay up while the others sleep. And finally, he's surrounded by boxes, shambling around the charmless apartment he never quite moved into after my mother divorced him, months before he died of cirrhosis of the liver. It's true, my dad drank himself to death. But that's not why I didn't know him. He wasn't a mean drunk or a binge drinker who disappeared from his children's lives. On the contrary, he was sociable and engaging. I'm told a raconteur who approached Ted Williams on a train platform in Baltimore in 1954 and talked him out of quitting baseball. I can't say why I don't remember him. Perhaps it's because most of 60s dads weren't as involved as they are today, overseeing playdates and attending back-to-school nights, or because I'm the youngest of five and there was only so much attention to go around, or because his job as a Pennsylvania state legislator required travel. The impact of his absence is deeper than the imprint of his presence, but less palpable. I love the smell of nicotine on men and cry when I hear, "You are my sunshine," probably because of my dad, possibly because of Willie Nelson. I have the vague but certain sense that he was kind. When she was young, my daughter, who nearly lost her father to cancer at exactly the age I lost mine to dry martinis, asked whether I ever missed my dad. She called him Eddie, and clearly wanted me to say yes, but the answer was no. You can't miss someone you never really knew. A close friend has what I consider a perfect father, loving and present, responsible and open. A new model dad I've known since my own father died. I observe their interaction with anthropological curiosity and shameless envy. And yet when I think about children who've lost a parent, it's the motherless ones who strike me as truly tragic. My mother was the one who endured. She packed her kids into our station wagon when I was almost nine. In the summer of 1969, the night after we watched the moonwalk on TV, and took us on a road trip to California, determined to show us a good time before we were flattened in the domestic train wreck she saw coming. She helped us pick up and move on. Because of her, I marvel that anyone can have a shred of self-esteem without a mother's guidance. But it turns out there's more to fathers than I knew, much of which I've learned from my husband. When my daughter calls him Daddy, a diminutive I never used, she owns him. A dad who taught her to cook and play chess, who made sure her first live concert involved fierce women playing loud guitars, whose presence is woven in her history. Her dad is real. Mine is a character who long ago shaded into fiction, a reconstruction mostly from other people's memories, which far outnumber my own. Notwithstanding whatever demons made him drink, from being adopted by emotionally distant parents to ferrying bombs across Europe during World War II, my father and I might have enjoyed a nice relationship had he lived. I saw him for the last time in a dream when I was 21. He was driving our family down a steep hill in a snowstorm as my mother touched his arm and told him he was going too fast. I awoke with a jolt and briefly felt his presence, an existential flash, a wave, an acknowledgement, perhaps even an apology, not so much for what had happened, but for what had not and never would. And there's a snapshot here of the author with her dad. 8-year-old Margot is standing in a delicate little floral print of a sundress with white ruffles around it. And her hair is cut just below her ears, so it doesn't even touch her shoulders. And it's blonde, and it's got a neat part, and she's pulled it behind her ears. And her dad's standing beside her with his arm around her, holding her shoulder. And he's wearing a brown, narrow-lapelled suit with a skinny brown striped tie. Margot Mifflin is the author most recently of The Blue Tattoo. Let's move now to the Feeling Good section of the magazine and finish up the articles that we started in the last installment. And this article is called The Other Breast Cancer. It's not all about pink ribbons and cures. Women living with metastatic cancer have their own kind of hope. October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, so you'll soon be hearing a lot about the disease, but probably not much about the metastatic kind. Metastatic means the cancer has spread to another part of the body, usually the lungs, liver, bones, or brain. It's also known as stage 4 cancer. Women initially diagnosed with stage 2 breast cancer have a 5-year survival rate of about 93%. With stage 3, it's about 72%. In stage 4, the rate drops to about 22%. Most breast cancer deaths are due to metastasis. It kills roughly 40,000 Americans each year. Now, the good news, though there's no cure for metastatic breast cancer, MBC, it can be treated with chemo, surgery, radiation, and increasingly targeted drugs. When a drug regimen is effective, the patient stays on it until it stops working, and then she tries a different medication. In January, the FDA expanded these life-lengthening options when it approved a new class of drugs for breast cancer called PARP, PARP inhibitors, which can slow the progression of the disease in stage 4 patients with BRCA mutations. Mark Hurlbut, Ph.D., Chief Mission Officer at the Breast Cancer Research Foundation, says, quote, "This shows we're moving in the right direction for improving survival," end of quote. April Doyle, 40, a cancer blogger in California's Central Valley, is well acquainted with the ins and outs of MBC treatment. Diagnosed with breast cancer at age 31, Doyle was told she was cured at 36, only to find out the same day that the doctor had spoken too soon. She had metastatic breast cancer in her bones. But while the median life expectancy for MBC patients is 3 years, she's been living and working, traveling, and parenting with it for 4. We asked Doyle for her advice to women who share her diagnosis. And there are 6 different bits of advice here. And the first one is, make sure your oncologist will go out of her way for you. Doyle says, quote, "We are at the mercy of our disease, so we need to feel like our doctors are doing everything they can to extend our lives for as long as possible. Look for someone you trust and don't be afraid to ask questions, push for answers, and say what's on your mind. It took me a few tries, but my current oncologist is amazing. He takes the time to explain everything to me," end of quote. The next bit of advice, don't suffer through the pain. Doyle says, "My cancer makes my whole body hurt, and the pain in my hips especially can hold me back from yoga, gardening, and riding bikes with my son. The cancer meds also make my joints ache, so I'll pop a painkiller when I need one. I also take a lot of Epsom salt baths. I love a good soak." And the third bit of advice, find your people. Doyle says, "Those in the same situation get what you're going through like no one else. But whether they're women you met in cancer support groups or longtime friends, connect with the ones you can be you with. My friends let me cry, scream, and drag them on trips to New Orleans or St. Thomas." The fourth bit of advice, live in the moment. From the day of my MBC diagnosis 4 years ago when my son was 3, my life has revolved around making memories with him. I don't know whether I'll be here when he has children, gets married, or even starts high school, so I do everything I can to make sure he'll remember how much I love him and the fun we had together. It's not always a big deal. Sometimes we're just playing board games or with Legos. I also love to travel, and the idea of my son remembering going somewhere with his mom fills my heart. I take lots of pictures and videos and overshare on social media. One day, that's all he'll have of me. And then the fifth bit of advice, think about what the future will hold for those who depend on you. She says, "My son's dad and I are divorced, but I want them to have a strong bond. Ditto my ex's parents. So my son will be well cared for if I'm not here someday. I make sure he spends quality time with them, even though it hurts to stay home without him." And the final bit of advice, always have something to look forward to. And Doyle says, I try not to let my life revolve around cancer. For example, I'm having radiation to help relieve some pain, but a week after I'm done, I'm going to Lake Tahoe. It's difficult some days, but I'm here now, and I believe in living like I'll be around for a while. And our last article in Feeling Good is C-Spot Chill, How to Help Your Anxious Pooch Relax. Your dog may not read headlines, navigate rush hour traffic, or worry about her 401k, but she can still get mighty stressed. In fact, vets say that as with people, anxiety in pets is on the rise, or at least better recognized than it was even a decade ago. Canine anxiety usually stems from simple causes. Being home alone, scary triggers like vacuum cleaners, thunder, a stranger, and insufficient exercise. Left untreated, psychological distress can lead to gastrointestinal woes, a weakened immune system, and thanks to a spike in the hormone cortisol, weight gain. Marty Becker, a veterinarian who founded Fear Free, a program to educate vets and owners about alleviating stress in pets, says, quote, one of the biggest reasons pets are obese is chronic stress, end of quote. Research shows that burned out pups even go gray earlier. Dogs, they're just like us. Whining, panting, pacing, obsessively eyeing her surroundings, and chewing on furniture could be signs that your four-legged friend is fighting anxiety. If you think she is, talk to your vet and try these techniques at home. And here are the techniques. Keep your cool. And because of time constraints, I'll abbreviate this. If your puppy feels that you're unhappy, that could make the puppy feel bad too. Take a few calming deep breaths to temper your bark and your bite. Curb the coddling. Jeff Gelman, owner of Solid Canine Training in Providence, says the goal is to teach dogs to self-soothe. When lightning or tension strikes, put your dog on his bed and give the stay command. Gelman says, dogs have a hard time focusing on two things at once, so if yours concentrates on holding a command, his fear of thunder will melt away, end of quote. The next bit of advice, give gold stars. If your puppy regularly whines and paces as you're getting ready to leave the house, don't toss out treats. Temple Grandin says you want to reward confident, not anxious behavior. To make goodbyes less stressful for dogs with separation anxiety, try this tip. 10 minutes before your departure, when your dog is still acting calm and polite, give her a puzzle toy filled with treats or a beloved rawhide bone that comes out only when you leave. If you do this consistently, she'll learn to look forward to seeing you lace up your shoes. And finally, try new tricks. The internet is littered with products to help ease canine anxiety. There are hemp snacks that may help dogs get calm but not stoned, canna-pet.com. The Thundershirt wrap applies gentle pressure to the dog's body. One study found that when canines with an anxiety disorder wore it, their heart rate stayed more level. Products like these can be nice add-ons to a consistent, healthy routine. And as we wrap up the September issue, let's hear from Oprah in What I Know For Sure. My favorite part of any conversation, Oprah says, on air or off, is when someone has a revelatory moment and utters these words, I never thought of it that way before. Case in point, Joanne Compton, whose daughter, Laurie-Anne, was murdered in 1988. For the next 10 years, this grieving mother didn't change a single thing in her daughter's room. A decade later, she was mourning her death as though she'd just passed away. Her plan was to share Laurie-Anne's story on The Oprah Show and then go home and kill herself. But when Joanne came on, Dr. Phil, in one awe-inspiring instant, changed everything. He said to her, your daughter lived 18 vibrant and wonderful years, yet you're focusing on the day of her death rather than celebrating the event of her life. I could see Joanne process that thought, and then the light bulb moment. I never thought of it that way before, she cried. Getting people to open to seeing things differently has been my life's work. I love when it happens to me, too. I once interviewed a group of women who were in prison for killing their children. When we finished, one of the inmates said, "You're the first person that's come in here and talked to us like we were normal women, not just murderers. How could you do that?" My response? I could feel your pain, and I recognized that all pain is the same. We just choose different ways to release it. This is what you chose to do with yours. You killed your children. Unspeakable, the depths of that crime, the horror, the shame. But my ability to set aside my preconceived notions and see those women as hurting human beings gone wrong, not monsters of evil, as some had been labeled in the press, changed the way I viewed everyone. I started to see that everybody's just doing the best they know how at any given time, and that even when they know better but can't do better, they often wish they could. What if you were willing to see your whole life differently from the 35,000-foot view? What if you could see everything you've been through, everything you've stood up to, every time you've fallen and rebounded, every curveball you were thrown and caught, every time you were disappointed and didn't stoop to despair, every victory, every chance, and appreciate the fact that you're still here, still standing, still striving for a better life? I hope you give yourself a round of applause for making it this far, and then see yourself as a part of the whole of this planet. What gifts have you to offer? What was your reason for coming? What I know for sure, the answers keep unfolding as your life expands. If you're willing to see things for what they are and what they can be. There's a picture from the 1993 show where Oprah is sitting with the four mothers who killed their children. And then there's a picture of Dr. Phil looking at Oprah as she hugs Joanne Compton in 1998. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope that you've enjoyed it. I'm Susan Dellinger, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.